Before I continue, a few announcements. A few of you came in a little bit late, but this is the Robert Taft Club. We're just a monthly meeting of conservatives and libertarians who think outside the box, as they say, on different issues, to discuss these issues civilly. Whatever anyone thinks about what everyone said, I don't think anyone thinks this is some sort of heresy that should have been stopped, I hope. So I'm going to ask everyone a question
Sure.
that I thought about, and then we're going to open it up to everyone else. So my first question will be to John. You talked a lot about black-white differences and a little bit about Hispanic immigration. But as you know, immigration is a huge issue, and I actually work in that full time, and I've met, for example, the last Bob Taft Club, Ted Hayes, is a left-wing black homeless advocate, was there, and he is violently anti-immigration because of the effects it has on Black America. So how do you think immigration in the Black-Hispanic relationship applies to all of this?
Well, I think that blacks, ordinary blacks, we're not talking about the black leadership, ordinary blacks are even more opposed to the Hispanicization of the United States than whites. They just very rarely get an opportunity to express themselves. They're, of course, the ones who end up with Hispanics in their neighborhoods much more frequently than whites do. They're the ones who find themselves competing with workers who are willing to work for sub-minimum wage jobs. I think that the big mistake that the leaders of the black community have made is somehow to assume that another group of non-whites is going to be allies against the white man. That obviously isn't taking place. Whether you look at the way Hispanics and blacks relate to each other in schools, in prisons, the workplace, there's a huge amount of dissension and division between the two. But no, in answer to your question, I think ordinary black people are absolutely opposed to this, probably in a more visceral way than whites are. It's only their leaders who haven't figured this out yet and who are leading them astray.
First of all, these are not leaders. Okay. They are not leaders. They are political operatives who are gone out and the media promotes them. No one sent the freaking ballot to my house and asked me if I wanted Jesse Jackson, Al Sharpton, Julius Carr, or any of these other cats to speak for me. Now, they talk about how illegitimate George W. Bush was. They're illegitimate black leaders. So let's sum that up right there.
That's all I got. I quite agree with that. I would entirely agree.
So call
that.
Them yeah. what they are.
On that note, my question to Mr. Morton is this. You all, like just now, you're talking about the illegitimate black leaders and blaming that for a lot of the victimology. And if anyone read Joe's last newsletter, he provides a lot of statistics about blacks believing that AIDS was invented by the government or crack cocaine was invented by the government or that the levees were bombed by white
America. George W. Bush and Carl Rove.
And I've never heard Jesse Jackson or Al Sharpton or any black, so-called black leaders say that. So if it's all the fault of the black leaders, where did these black Americans get these crazy ideas from then?
Okay, let me say this to you. There are two forms. When you look at the average Jesse Jackson or any of these other quote-unquote leaders out here, they're chameleons. They know that they can go on NBC and say, okay, well, the government's response was slow, blah, 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 blah. Then they will come back to our community in a form and say, okay, along with Louis Farrakhan, well, I know that George W. Bush and Karl Rove bombed the levees down there on 9th Street, causing the Lower Ninth Ward to flood. The problem that conservatives have, and the reason why blacks believe these conspiracy theories, a majority of them, is because there has been no aggressive type of conservative, hey, look, we're not going to take this anymore. You're going to prove your daggone point. Okay, if you blew up the levee down in the Ninth Ward, you know, we'll send somebody down there, an explosives expert. You got to come up with some C4 or something. Okay, but when conservatives don't fight, just like my colleague here said, conservatism, and I said earlier, it is easier for a person to say I'm gay than to say that I'm conservative in my community. And if conservatives are not outreaching and say, look, Jesse, prove your daggone point. If we blew up these levees, if George W. Bush doesn't support hate crimes legislation, if all conservatives are racist, prove it. that would shut him up. That would shut a lot of them up. It's just like, okay, take this. You mentioned Tom Tancredo early. Did everyone in here see that little thing with Cynthia McKinney and her little... Yeah. Now, could you imagine if Tom Tancredo had done that? Okay. Chris Matthews. Let's see. Paula Zahn. Everybody would have tied Tom Tancredo on TV, pigeonholed him a racist, and invited Jesse to come on and meet the nation and face the nation and all this other stuff. See, liberals had a well-orchestrated smear machine. And as long as conservatives are scared to talk about race, they will continue to be able to do what they do and say the levees were bombed, the government's response was slow. It's just like people tell me this. Okay, well, wait a minute. Bill Clinton was the first black president. Okay, they always say that. Now, could you imagine if George W. Bush had let the nation of Rwanda go to war with itself and 800,000 Africans were slaughtered? They would portray him as a racist all day long. But Bill Clinton did it, and it's just a hiccup in society. It's a hiccup in history. Oh, well, we could have did more. We should have did more. You know, they always say he lied, he hyped intelligence. Well, damn, saying that ethnic cleansing isn't ethnic cleansing or doesn't meet the definition of ethnic cleansing. If it walks like a duck and takes water to duck it like a duck, it must be a duck. So what I'm trying to say is, conservatives have to start defining themselves to combat this level of, I just want to call it gibberish, that's constantly coming out, and confront it and say, look, we're going to confront you with facts and real facts, not speculation, not that you know, it's Karl Rove with some mind control machine in the basement of the White House. No, we're going to confront you with real issues. And like my esteemed colleague said, it's time for the conservative movement to stop being scared of talking about race. Talk about it. Talk about that we only belong to one race, and that's the human race. I might not agree with my colleague over here on everything, but he's still a human. He has his right to his opinion, and I'm not going to shut that down. Okay? No one has a right to shut anyone else's opinion down in this country. And it's time for conservatives to seize upon that.
And my final question is, Mr. Gorbachev, you can correct me if I'm wrong in summarizing your opinion shortly, but you seem to agree that, I guess, that Mr. Taylor may be right about some of his biological facts, but probably that Mr. Morton's right in the sense that we should treat everyone, that we should look at all the issues in a colorblind fashion. Would that be pretty...
Yes, I would like to, if my dreams could come true, one, as Kevin said, we'd all be talking honestly and calmly about race instead of getting into panics and status games about it. And number two, we would dismantle all this vast tottering structure of social engineering gimmicks that we've put together the last 30 or 40 years, all the affirmative action programs, all the anti-discrimination laws. Let's have freedom of association. Let's talk to each other as citizens to citizens. I don't know how many of you read the VDARE website, but a few months ago, Jared had a little debate with Steve Saylor, where Jared was arguing a white nationalist viewpoint, or a viewpoint that whites should organize and struggle the way other racial groups do, and Steve was opposing that with what Steve called citizenism, that we're all citizens, and our government, our authorities, ought to regard us all equally, and they ought to prefer our interests to the interests of the other 6 billion people in the world, which currently they don't. And I'm on board with that. I'm kind of on Steve's side on that. I'm not a white nationalist. I'd be in trouble at home if I was. I agree with Steve. Citizenism. We're all citizens. We ought to be able to talk to each other as citizens. and we ought to put our collective interests as citizens before the interests of foreigners, let alone foreigners who've broken into our country against the law.
Okay, thank you. And with that said, Steve Salo had actually wanted to come down here, but because of financial and stuff, he's from California. If any, like I said, if any of you are wealthy or would like to help fly him down, he said he'd be happy to debate Gerard on a similar topic like that. And we have at least 45 minutes, we'll see if they keep them out. So we will now open it up for discussion, and we'll have a few questions, but because, again, this is unorganized, we don't have any official debate, we'll have a few questions, but if any of the speakers want to ask the other speakers a direct question, we'll allow that in a few, so you can think about that in the meantime.
For Kevin, why is it you think that blacks that go to private black schools do better than blacks in integrated schools, on average?
Because as the son of a former public school teacher and a product of Maryland public school systems, which I will very rarely acknowledge, I will say like this. Children who go to private, black children who go to private schools, their parents are forced to participate. Just like your car, you have a car, right?
Yeah.
You pay a note on it, right?
Yeah.
Okay. You make sure you take care of the car, right? You take it in, you get it maintenance, put oil in it. If you can't do that, you get a warranty, right?
Right.
Anything goes wrong, you take it back to the dealership, they fix it, right? Okay. Now, that's how private schools are viewed. Public school is it's actually a right in this country. Voting is a privilege. Public school education is actually a right. But the public education school system and those who live, because in America we've gotten in this entitlement mentality. Okay, the government, it's just like down in New Orleans. All right, it wasn't the fault of the federal government. It was the fault of state and local politicians down there. I know. I used to go to Southern University, so I can tell you. It was the fault of the politicians down there, right? But when Hurricane Katrina blew through, it blew out of proportion. What did they do? Oh, the federal government should have came in. You know, Bush should have come here. He should have, like President Bush should have been running through the waters of my Lord Night War, telling black folk to get out because Red Nation couldn't do it, because Kathleen Blocko couldn't do it, and the police was totally inept. When I say that, I'm saying when you look at public school, people have got it in their minds, especially in my community, that, oh, public school is somewhere where you send your child for 8 hours and really just be babysat. I mean, don't get me wrong when I say this, and I have to come along racial lines. White parents constantly tell their children, you are going to achieve something. I know children who have been disowned by their parents, because they are, A, they're not going to college to be a doctor or a lawyer. They decided to maybe go in the military, you know, try to find themselves, you know, go across the country. They've been disowned. In my community, because of the quote-unquote leaders, and we're all made to feel ashamed. Well, you know, we all came through slavery together. We all came through civil rights. So that's why we have leaders. Because in their minds, we're too stupid to know what to really see self-destiny by itself. Well, like I told somebody on TV one time, I said, I do not go home at night, sit in a corner, and cry for 2 hours because I'm black. Okay? Every night. But if you listen to the rhetoric that comes out of the mouth of these quote-unquote leaders, everything is, oh, you're black, it's not your fault. You're black, oh, you didn't get a quality education, it's because you're black. It's because the white man's trying to hold you down. It's because of the stain of slavery and oppression, white oppression. See, that's why I say conservatives have to open that door. Conservatives have to be willing to talk about race. You're not going to agree with it. Everybody's not going to agree with it. Everyone has their own opinion. But for the 40-plus years, a segment of American society has been told that you can't achieve, that the government owes you something. See, public school in my community is seen as something that's owed to us. Okay, because at one time we couldn't read or write. It was illegal for us to read and write. Okay, so our quote-unquote leaders have been told, well, you're owed that. That's why black children in public schools are not achieving as what like their private school counterparts are. And you have a school system in this country, whether it be no child left behind, any child left back, whatever. Okay, that reinforces that. It reinforces that. Because it's like, okay, he can't achieve. Oh, you know, we'll put him on some Ritalin or something. Okay, how many kids who go to private school are actually on Ritalin? Very few. That answers your question right there. You have a society that has convinced itself, because liberals dominate the issue of race, and conservatives, namely Republicans, will not talk about it. That's why you have that type of mentality. When you start talking about the issue, like my colleague has over here, might not agree with everything he says, then the door is open. My other colleague said, it's time to open the door. It's time to talk about this. It's time to find out, why are black children not achieving like their private school counterparts? Let's have a debate like that. But Jesse Jackson and those who were appointed will not.
I got a question
for John Derbyshire. Most of the immigrants coming into the U.S. are Asian or Hispanic. And assuming that there is no immigration reform, and assuming that the black community doesn't take Kevin's advice and follows leaders like Jesse Jackson and Al Sharpton, what would be wrong with white people, say, having white Jesse Jackson or white Al Sharpton? And whether it's wrong or not, do you foresee that happening in the next 20, 30 years?
Okay, that's a two-parter. What would be wrong with it would be that you would be sowing discord. That's what would be wrong with it. And that's what I think, Jared won't mind me saying so, I think that's what Jared ultimately is doing. He's a sower of discord. And if you remember your Dante's Inferno, the sowers of discord do not have a happy fate. But again, that goes back to my own perhaps rather rose-coloured spectacle view of America, of the ideal America that I would like to see. All right, I think that covers the first part. The second part, do I think it's going to happen? No, I don't. I do think that the immigration issue is coming to some kind of a head. I don't know if we'll really come to another 1924, but I think there will be big restrictions. And that will mean that for the foreseeable future, certainly to the end of my lifetime, which, hey, is all I care about, whites will be a big majority in America. And not only will they continue to be a big majority, but they're a self-confident majority. Jared said something in his opening remarks about how whites don't actually think much about minorities. White Americans don't actually spend much time thinking about black Americans or Hispanic Americans or Asian Americans, because they see themselves as mostly competing with other white people. They don't see these other groups as being competitive. In some cases, because they're just not numerous enough to be competitive. And in some cases, because white people, I think, know in their hearts the kind of thing that Jared was telling us and that I've come to accept, that there are some intrinsic differences there that make minorities less competitive in a lot of the fields that matter to Americans nowadays. So I think whites will go on blithely ignoring minorities as much as they can. And to have the kind of thing that Jared wants, to have a white consciousness movement where white people are thinking about their whiteness and asking, how can we advance the interests of white people? To have that, you've really got to have white Americans in a state of insecurity. And I don't see how white Americans are going to get to that state of insecurity. I don't think they're going to get there numerically, because I think the immigration issue will be taken care of sufficiently to prevent them getting there numerically. And I don't think they'll get there psychologically, because white Americans, for all the guilt-mongering and for all the pandering and so on, they're just too self-confident. Six or seven years ago, Jared's magazine published an article by Robert Weisberg. Do you know the article I'm talking about?
Mm-hmm.
Where he said that, all right, it's a mess. He said all the things I said. You know, it's all gone wrong and it's all a mess. We've got all these stupid programs. But that's the best we can hope for. It's an equilibrium point. You know, it's an imperfect world and we've got an imperfect mess here. But if we try to do anything, it'll just get worse. So let's just sit back and accept it. And that kind of stuck in my mind. It's a council of despair in a way. But I think a lot of whites are in that frame of mind. Yeah, it's stupid. Yeah, affirmative action's silly. And, you know, it's costing all this money for diversity consultants and so on. But hey, the alternative's probably worse. And we can put up with it. So I don't think that that white people will either numerically or psychologically come to the point of insecurity where they feel they need what Jared Taylor is trying to sell them.
On the subject of sowing discord, I think that is surely, you must admit, that the faintest of all possible reproaches. I mean, after all, the great heroes of liberalism did nothing but sow discord. The women's livers, the homosexual rights people, the civil rights. In the United States today, to say that someone is wrong because he's sowing discord is to turn his back completely on the entire liberal venture, if you would, which is the one that gets the most approval. I think that if you have a group that established a country, built its institutions, and is now being told that their racial stock is somehow insufficient, that they must celebrate diversity, and that the celebration of diversity is to celebrate their own replacement, their own dwindling numbers and influence, for them not to say something about that, that is what is strange. You say, I think you make a good point about the current psychological state of whites, that many of them perhaps have said, well, it's a terrible situation, my grandchildren will be racial minorities, but I won't sow discord. That, I think, is the fatal flaw that white people are possibly capable of making, not just in the United States, but in every white society. Unless they are prepared to sow discord, they will be reduced to minorities. Despised minorities in the places where they have built the institutions, left their stamp on every aspect of society. Unless they are willing to sow discord, they will simply be shoved aside by history.
This one's mainly from Mr. Derbyshire. In some of your explanations and answers, it seems as though there's a certain acknowledgement of some truth to Mr. Taylor's claims, and yet a certain reluctance or reticence to acknowledge that there may be racial differences. Do you think that there are racial differences in terms of athletic abilities, in terms of intelligence, in terms of achievement, across, as you pointed out, statistically across the entire set of populations? Certainly there are outliers. But do you believe that there are racial differences? And if there are, does that mean that the civil rights movement is somewhat flawed in expecting an equality? And in addition, I think I'm not just asking if there are racial differences, but the Sam Francis line of, do you think European and Western civilization would be the same if another race was switched out for it?
To answer the first part, yes, I do think there are racial differences. I think we've reached the point now where it can't be denied. The causes of those differences we can still discuss. And I'm not sure if you're asking me if I think that there are racial differences or if I think that there are intrinsic racial differences. Perhaps you'd like to tell me.
Intrinsic,
yes, I do think there are intrinsic racial differences. It would actually be astounding if there weren't. From what we know about how populations of living creatures develop, it would be absolutely astounding. In any population of living creatures, well, not quite any, but in almost any population of living creatures, you observe variations among the individuals. There are variations. Some of these variations are heritable. Amongst human beings, red hair is heritable. And some of them are not. Appendectomy scars are not heritable. So you have variations in any population. Some of these variations give you an edge in the survival game. You know, if you're a moth and you have the right camouflage for your environment, you've got a better chance of surviving and breeding. Or if you're a human being in a hunter-gatherer society and you have poor eyesight, you've got a less chance. That's all. Darwin put this all together for us. He said, if a variation is both heritable and advantageous, it will increase in frequency through the population. And he said that's how populations change. We've been observing this for 150 years now, and Darwin was right. That's how populations change. And we actually now, we're beginning, since the genomic revolution, we're beginning to understand some of the actual chemical mechanisms that make that happen. Now, if you take your population and you cut it in two and put one half over here and one half over there, perhaps on an island or somewhere quite different, and then you watch for a few hundred generations, if the cut was random, your menu of variations in this population would be a bit different from the menu of variations in that population. Also, the environments might be different. So there might be different stresses. There might be different survival stresses. This one might be cold and this one might be hot. So as you watch those two populations, they're going to develop, as populations do, but in different ways. They're going to develop group differences. Now, the little band of human beings who came out of Africa 50,000 years ago and spread all over the world did exactly that. They settled in small groups in all kinds of different environments. They interbred mostly among themselves, very little gene flow between the different populations for hundreds of generations, and they developed group characteristics. Presumably, if it had gone on for a few thousand more generations, we might have observed speciation, because according to Darwin, that is the origin of species. But it didn't. It only went on. 50,000 years is not very long, biologically speaking. It's long enough for small group differences to develop, but not for speciation. And so, since we know all that, it would be astounding. It would be statistically astounding if there weren't group differences, intrinsic group differences. Steve Saylor likes to say that the left hates Darwin and the right hates Darwin, but they hate Darwin for different reasons. The right hates Darwin because they think God makes everything happen. The left doesn't quite hate Darwin. They like Darwin, but only up to that point 50,000 years ago when the humans left Africa. They're happy with Darwin up to that point. After that, no evolution, no variation, no change, no. Well, I'm sorry, but biologically that's just preposterous. That's preposterous. So yes, I do think they were very small, they're manageable. I do believe we can all get along. But yes, I do think there are intrinsic variations. And as I said before, I don't know why anybody should be distressed about it, any more than we're distressed about our individual differences. In fact, it seems to me, since human beings are made to relate individually, face to face, much more competently than we relate to great masses of people. I can remember his name, but I can't remember all your names, you know. It seems to me that individual differences ought to be more distressing and more stressful to us than group differences. So if we can handle our individual differences, which we do, why shouldn't we be able to handle group differences? I don't get it. It seems to me we could handle it. You had a second part to your question, but I've forgotten it.
Yes. If there are disparities, and directly if there are disparities in intelligence, on an individual level, yes, but is the civil rights movement then based on a flawed proposition, which is that you'll get equality of results? In addition, an answer to the Sam Francis line of, do you think whether the civilization would have happened the same if change the race?
Well, the civil rights movement, the main force driving the civil rights movement was the desire to correct an injustice. It wasn't the desire to have equal outcomes. Mm-hmm. Although, as I said, at the time we all thought there would be equal outcomes, but that wasn't what was driving the civil rights movement. What was driving the civil rights movement was the indignities being suffered by black Americans under Jim Crow and the widespread recognition of that. So I don't really think that's relevant. If America were to be colonized by, you know, Somalians or Sri Lankans, would Western civilization survive? I have no idea. I suspect it wouldn't, but the prospect seems to me pretty remote. As I've said, I think we're going to take care of this. I don't think that the present extraordinary levels of immigration are going to continue. I don't believe that. I think we will take care of it. We took care of it in 1924. I don't know if we'll take care of it quite as decisively as we did in 1924, but I think we're sensible enough that we won't let this go on.
Okay. You, and then we're going to... Everyone keep this brief so you can have some questions.
Oh, sorry. Did I talk too much?
Everyone did.
Yeah.
Brief answers, and then we're going to let... So, why don't you go, and then... I'm going to let everyone ask a question to each other, and then we'll see if they can get out.
I have a question for Jared Taylor. Okay. You might follow up on Mr. Derbyshire's earlier point that whites have nothing to fear because he believes the demographics are going to stabilize, but that will remain a racial majority. If you're aware of what the census of demographics is trying to suggest.
Well, as a matter of fact, even if immigration were to stop tomorrow, whites are destined to minority status. If you look at the age distribution, school-aged children in the primary grades are already a minority in more than half the states of the United States. And if all we need to do is watch that age cohort work its way through the various succeeding ages, and combine that with differential reproduction rates, and whites will become a minority, not maybe in 2050, but just it'll take another 50 years. There are similar predictions for the United Kingdom, you know. In about 100 years, given immigration and given demographic reproduction rates, whites will become a minority. Now, I think it's unrealistic, and it's unfair, really, to say, well, don't worry about it now. Maybe worry about it 50 years from now. That doesn't make sense. If we can see a catastrophe on its way, our job is to do something about it now, not force our grandchildren to deal with this catastrophe. I think, wasn't it Enoch Powell who said that the main purpose of government is to deal with foreseeable catastrophes? I think in that respect, our government has betrayed not just whites, but everyone in this country who will suffer if it becomes a nation with really no central binding core, no sense of coherence, no attachments to its past institutions. I think that would be a betrayal of blacks who are here today. Everyone who is here today would be a terrible betrayal. So no, I think the issue, even if we had a 1924 style immigration law, the future for whites is one of this dwindling minority, sort of living on the last gasps of its heritage, and not only a dwindling minority, but I think the evidence is clear, an increasingly a despised minority. So I believe the crisis is now, and that if we wait, as Mr. Derbyshire suggests, we will eventually reach a point in which it will be impossible to control immigration.
I believe Powell's line was to see and not to speak would be the great betrayal.
Aphoristically, yes.
So now we're going to have a formal debate. Everyone ask one question. Again, try to keep it as brief as possible. We'll go left or right.
All right.
So you can ask a question either to Derbyshire or Mr. Morton.
Okay. I get to ask the first
question? Yeah.
All right. Yes. My esteemed and learned colleague, Mr. Derbyshire, I do have a question for you.
All right.
You suggested that the reasons why these rosy hopes for the civil rights movement were dashed were because of the social engineering of the time, and that absent the social engineering, we really would be marching off into this multiracial paradise in which race would be made not to matter. Well, I would suggest to you that the social engineering was of a kind to bring the races together. Integration, busing, the forced employment through affirmative action, making people mix. The social engineering, if there had been no social engineering at all, a complete libertarian society, would we not be even more separate than we are today?
No, I don't think we would. I think what keeps us separate, and what's increasingly separating us in the ways that I spelled out, is in large part the kinds of animosities created by all that social engineering. I think if people have been left to their own devices, I think if people have been left to themselves, they really could have sorted something out. And I still think that we can. I still believe that we can sort it out. I don't think we're going to see proportional representation in absolutely every area of life, but I think that's something we can live with. As I said, as we live with our own individual differences, I think we could also live with group differences. I think the great harm was done by those social engineering projects. And, as you said, and here's another point I agree with you about, and by this dogmatic refusal to face up to even the possibility of group differences. Because, as you said, I find it a very powerful and convincing argument. If everybody believes that there are absolutely no group differences, if a black person walks out of his house and looks around the society and sees black people doing badly in school, badly in jobs, the only thing he can logically conclude is that white people are putting him down. So I think that bad ideology, bad ideas, bad social engineering have made things far worse than they needed to be. I don't know if we'd ever reach racial utopia. I doubt if we'd ever reach proportional representation in all spheres of life. But I do think it would have been much better without all those programs and without the imposition of that, I believe, false ideology.
Mr. Martin?
I want to add one thing, and then I'll answer my question. First of all, we talk about all these programs, gentlemen, but let's get to the root of the matter. Racism is rooted in ignorance, and you can't outlaw ignorance. I don't care who you are. You cannot outlaw ignorance. And like you said, if we would have been left to our own, we would have eventually figured out and came together and said, look, we're all one, we're all in this together. It would might have taken a little bit of time. Affirmative action, all these other wonderful, all this other wonderful gobbledygook that we said in the 1960s, the Great Society and all this, look what it has done. We are more separated now. I mean, we live a phony life. We walk out the door. I'm going to take that young lady up there, for example. I'm sorry I have to do this. But if I'm walking down the street towards her, and she has a purse, and she's alone, she's going to pull that purse towards her. No. I'm not saying it's not your fault, but you understand what I'm saying. If statistics bear out, as you have said, for me as a 36-year-old black man, I am a drooling sex fiend, barely conscious of my own cognitive thought and existence. No. You all are laughing, but there are people who do believe this. As she walks down the street towards me, because of slavery and everything I've been through, I have the right to take $50 out of her purse and rape her. Okay? That's why she pulls her purse towards her, because this is what society has statistically told us is going to happen. Okay, so it makes it easy. It's just like watching a bunch of crows pick at a possum that's run over the road. They all get together at one time because it's a group thing. Okay, but they live individually until something brings them together. This whole gobbledygook we were fed in the 60s is like a dead possum in the road. And now we're all coming there to pick the bones clean and see who can get the better piece. That's what I firmly believe. Now my question for you.
Yes, sir.
We talk about statistics. Statistics this, statistics that. Liberals talk about statistics. Conservatives talk about statistics. But I've never seen a statistic that suggests that we have something in common. The only time I really saw us really have something in common, and I'm just going to say this as a whole, was maybe on 9/11 when we all came together and said, hey, you know, we're Americans, someone's attacking us and trying to kill us. But from that, we all went back to our respective camps. Why is it that as you say, these leaders, why is it that they're empowered, as I asked you earlier, why is it that only these minority communities have leaders? And if statistics bear out, like you say, and whites slowly become a minority, okay, will there be white Jesse Jacksons, white Al Sharpens? Will statistics bear that we'll be even a more racially divided country than we are now? If we're not focusing in on, and you said, if my esteemed colleague over here said, equality. Equality is an idea. You cannot take a man or a woman and say they're equal. Women can do things that men can do because statistics say they can. Okay? Women and men are different. So how is it, how do we ever, if statistics bear out, won't we even be more divided along racial and gender lines if all these statistics bear out? Because you say some minorities rank below whites and Asians in certain cognitive functions and things like that. Why is it that we're divided by statistics? Why do we remain so divided by statistics? And why are you
voting? The fact is, if you want to look at the genetics of human groups, there is an enormous amount of genetic commonality.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact is, human beings love to fasten on the things that are different, the one from one to another. We are very tribal in our nature. Just think, for example, the kinds of hot loyalty to an athletic team that people can work up, whether a college team or a city team or a professional team. This is an expression of the inherent tribalism human beings have. I remember I went to Yale, and my freshman year I went to the Harvard-Yale football game at Harvard, and I only could get tickets on the Harvard side. Well, the Yale team was just beating the pants off the Harvard team, and I was, of course, cheering lustily for my team. Well, they'd got to the point where I stopped cheering so lustily because I had a certain fear for my physical safety. Now, when you think about it, demographically, statistically, genetically even, probably Harvard students and Yale students are not all that different. And yet the kind of fierce tribalism that we had worked up over this ritual opposition with the ancient enemy was so great that I really had to curb my tongue sitting there in the Harvard stands. Now, this is an illustration to me of what some might call the failed state of our species. I think it is a realistic aspect of the way we simply are. We fasten onto these differences. There's our group and there's their group. And the fact that some people would call this a misfortune, I think it's a simple biological fact. The clearest and most obvious difference that people can fasten onto is appearance. And the aspect of appearance that is most fundamentally different is that set of appearance differences that are reflected by race. So I believe that we would have to change human nature if we were to overcome these differences, and I believe that any project, political or sociological or otherwise, that is dependent on changing human nature is bound to fail.
Well, it was in a roundabout way, but thank you for coming around. Like I said, it's all in the mind.
Just a side note, to interject, but I don't necessarily, I'm not a biologist, but there's a book called All Genetic Interest by a biologist at the Max Planck Institute named Frank McSaltle, which discusses, if anyone wants to read Portal,
they can look into it.
It's a very good book.
Okay. I enjoy reading.
Okay. Mr. Dolbshire?
Well, I'd like to ask Jared a question. I happen to know that Jared has a day job and that American Renaissance occupies a lot of his free time, and he has a family to look after, and it must be a bit of a burden to him. I'd like to ask him this. What would make you stop doing what you do? What would make you say... Okay, this is the best we can expect. I've got some kind of result. By all my agitation and all my work, I've got some kind of result. I've changed society in some ways. What ways, at a minimum, would be sufficiently satisfactory to you that you'd close down American Renaissance?
Well, I would consider my work done, and I would close shop if we stopped immigration and eliminated all anti-discrimination laws. Now, that would not mean that the culture that I love would necessarily survive, but it would give it a good chance. Those two things. Those are the only two political exercises that I've ever advocated, is stopping immigration and getting rid of all anti-discrimination laws. I don't think you'd be in much opposition to those two policies either. But what I would have to say in all candor is, if those things took place because whites decided that they had to preserve their society, then other things would happen as well. I can't predict what they would be, but those are the two important steps. And if those were to happen, then I would be perfectly content to sun myself and shut down American Renaissance.
Good answer.
I guess we'll keep on going for a little bit. People want to be even though I'm late, I grew up in Dallas, but I grew up.
Yeah.
Okay. Oh, how, like, how long?
Oh, I believe it.
Oh, gosh. Well, I suppose if we still have an audience.
Okay.
Can you address some of the fallacies that people bring up most commonly about race and genetics, what we're really talking about? For example, lots of people talk about culture. Culture does this. Culture brings about the differences that we have in race. But yet, they never look outside, for example, America, and see worldwide differences. Can you elaborate on, you know, the biggest fallacies?
To whom are you asking that? To me? Well, I must say, I'm always amused when people insist that different outcomes are somehow the consequence of culture. It's as if cultures just drop out of the sky and the lucky people get the good ones. For example, Asians do remarkably well in this country. Your group, in fact, I believe, now has about the highest per capita income, these are Indians, of any group in the United States. The notion, of course, that culture can be completely separated from the genetics of the creating people seems to me obviously absurd. I think E.O. Wilson once pointed out that genetics holds culture on a leash. It's a long leash, but the culture cannot be separated from the biological substrate that created it. So I believe that is, if not necessarily a fallacy, it's a very common attempted shortcut for people to avoid dealing with what really accounts for group differences in success or failure, which is inherent biological differences.
Michael?
This question is for Mr. Taylor. You described your group identity at a sporting event. You took this on as it was a demonstration of some kind of tribalism. But isn't that, in fact, a demonstration that tribalism is in many ways a constructed category, that it's malleable? That, in fact, you could possibly construct, say, an American or a citizenist identity and make that a culture-wide accepted or primary identity, which people give their allegiance. And while racial differences may persist throughout that society, they are in some way mitigated by a strong commitment by the elite towards Americanization or an American identity.
I think that's a very interesting and provocative question. I think it's certainly true that our identities are malleable. I think at the same time our identities are overlapping and concentric. My foremost identity is to my family. I think probably that's the same with all of us. And then we have larger identities, either as Christians or as Americans or as New Yorkers or Virginians, whatever it is. And many of these overlap and many of them expand. And I think that under certain circumstances, like Mr. Martin mentioned after the September 11 attacks, there was a sense of unity in the United States. Under extreme circumstances, I think that even the most diverse people, if there were an invasion from Mars, I think you would get a more united world than is otherwise possible. In the face of a really extreme outside threat, yes, even very divergent people can come together. Fortunately, or perhaps unfortunately, we're not being threatened by an invasion from Mars. And I think that, as I said before, the biology of race is such as to make that practically an unavoidable identity. And wherever you find people of different races, you will find that identity. The parallel that I like to draw is, as I said before, my first loyalty is to my family. I love my children more than I love your children. And I make no apology for it. And I love them not because they're necessarily better than your children. They might not be better, but they're mine. And I think that's the way people feel about race. Race is sort of their extended family. At what point is my preferring my cousin or my second cousin once removed to your cousin, at what point does that become bigotry, or at what point is it natural? People draw their extended family lines in different places, but ultimately for all of us, I think the race is the largest unit to which we feel a kind of organic loyalty. And I think you find manifestations of that everywhere. Wherever you find people of different races coming into contact, you find that. And so you're right to say that our loyalties, our tribalisms are malleable. I think that's a very important point, and they can be shoved in one direction or another direction. They can expand, they can contract. But I believe that certain things, family, and as an extension of family, our biological relatedness to our larger family group, that's something that is very, very difficult to overcome.
Yes, I'd like to direct my question to Mr. Derbyshire. I occasionally have pleasant suspicions that maybe mainstream conservative writers, such as write for National Review, might not be as foolish as they frequently sound to me when they write about race, that they actually know all the kinds of facts that and the kinds of statistics that Mr. Taylor presents, just as well as Mr. Taylor himself does, but that they are afraid to discuss these because of concerns over advertising revenue, loss of donor base. Is there anything to that suspicion, or do they actually believe the tepid cliches that they usually utter?
Wow.
And I'm not asking you to name names.
I am.
Well, first of all, let me say that I am not an employee of National Review. I'm only a contributing editor. I send in a piece, they look at it, say, yeah, we can use that, we'll give you $200 for that. Or they say, no, can't use that. Sorry. So I'm not an employee of National Review, and I have no right to speak for National Review. Second thing, I try not to make a habit of guessing about what other people think. I think the best is to rely on what they say if they say it repeatedly and consistently. So I'm not going to get into trying to guess what people think. William F. Buckley has a phrase that I liked very much. He speaks about the prevailing structure of taboos. The prevailing structure of taboos. Buckley did a very clever thing. The conservative movement that he came to in the 1950s was a bit of a mess. And it had all sorts of odd hangers-on. You know, the John Birchers and people like that. And he did, and he has always done, a sort of policing action. This has a downside and an upside. The downside is he ticks off a lot of people. The upside is that it does keep conservatism respectable. That's one of those unhappy trade-offs that you just have to make. And he made it, and I think he made it very well. And I think, I'm only guessing, but I think that that philosophy prevails at National Review, in the heads of National Review editors, that they feel that there is a prevailing structure of taboos, that to keep the eyes on the prize, to keep the conservative movement viable in the public sphere, you can't ignore that prevailing structure of taboos. They probably think, well, you know, we could print the kind of thing Gerard Taylor prints, perhaps. Hey, it's conservatism, and these are conservative people. But then we'd no longer be respectable, and we'd have lost something important, and we're not willing to lose that. That's the trade-off that mainstream conservatives make. I think they're wise to make it. I think it's a good trade-off to make. I think the kind of knowledge that's now bubbling up from the human sciences, from neuroscience, from genetics, from genomics, I believe, I've been at Natural for some years, and I believe I see an increasing willingness to accept the reality of that and to come to terms with it in the way I've sketched. We can come to terms with group differences, surely at least as well as we come to terms with our individual differences. Why shouldn't we? And I do think there's an increasing openness to that, but that's just a guess. And I'm not going to indulge in guesses about what might National Review colleagues think in the privacy of their chambers.
Again, to moderately moderate, I did my honors thesis on the history of the conservative movement, and whatever the taboos of William F. Buckley did, if you look at what Buckley said in 1957, it would be more taboo than some of the things which Mr. Taylor said. For example, he said that whites in the South had a duty to ensure that they are the majority and ruling race in terms of voting. They, before a lot of these genetic stuff, before the Bell Corps, before Arthur Jensen, they published articles when the evidence was relatively spotty, such as by Ornus von der Haag on racial differences in IQ, whether or not they're right or wrong. And they also explicitly denounced the 1965 Immigration Act on the same reasons that Mr. Taylor did. And even 15 years ago, when John O'Sullivan and Peter Brimler were much more prominent, they probably didn't go quite as far as Mr. Taylor went, but they certainly went. They were not denouncing the tribal politics of Pat Buchanan and saying that all unpatriotic conservatives were closet Klansmen, like they do today. So,
but that's their calculation, Marcus, and they have to make it, and perhaps they don't always get it right, I don't know. But they do, I do think they're right to try to make that calculation, to try to balance off the virtue of being respectable within that prevailing structure of taboos and trying to advance the conservative cause. Maybe they don't always get it right, but it's an effort worth making.
We're going to have two more questions, I guess. So, Sully, I'm going to have to cut a few people off, but I'm going to say Kevin, and then you, and then maybe if they can stick around, go for that. So, Kevin?
I guess just one thing I'm going to have a comment is an agreement that we do need to at least discuss openly about these kinds of issues, and that we require subverting prevailing beliefs. Can this be done within the existing conservative paradigm, or do you need a new movement along the lines of the movements which you started to emerge in Europe, groups like the Jewish National Party?
I'm sorry, you're asking me?
No, I was getting ready.
Okay.
You want to take that one, that's fine.
I think the conservative movement needs to do a lot of self-reflecting on itself. It's just as I was watching Tavis Smiley's State of the Black Union 2006 on C-SPAN. And one thing that struck me odd about it, and to quote my esteemed colleague here, there was a sense of tribalism there. I saw nothing more than victimology 101. I mean, it might as well have changed its title there. There were what you would call, and I wouldn't even call these people conservatives because they reflected on the ideals that I had. There were a few what they call moderate and token conservatives. But at the end of the day, it all came back to that one thing. I'm a victim, the federal government owes me, blah, 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 white oppression, white supremacy, blah, 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 the cause of all our problems. Statistically speaking, I am what you would call an oddity in my community. I'm a conservative. Statistically speaking, I should have yo, yo, yo coming out of my mouth after every other sentence. That's why I don't really believe in statistics, bell curves, or anything like that. I'm just as intelligent. I understand classical music. I understand the arts and everything like that. Maybe I am an oddity in my community. But until conservatives come to the realization that we do need, in fact, do need to sit down and have a genuine debate on race, not something that we invite the media to and it's a classical event and they can take it back to their chop shop and chop it up whatever way they want to, something that's genuine, something that's real, a real discussion on race. And as people have always said, or others have said, when we talked about avenues, well, you can't have a discussion on race without inviting all these leaders. Okay, but once again, who picks these leaders? Okay, I mean, it's just like, take for instance, we have women in the room. I'm sure, how many of y'all belong to the National Organization of Women? Feminist Majority, any of those groups? Okay. So statistically speaking, in America, they are also oddities. Okay, because they're not having this tribal gang up. That, oh, okay, they're in the majority, so I have to belong. If conservatives really want to have a discussion on race, get a segment of a society that is achieving. Like, he's left since. The young man asked me about black children in private schools. The reason they excel is because of parental involvement, the parents are paying out money, but I have watched children be taken out of the worst performing schools and statistically they're 2 years behind. And they're put into a private school environment and they catch up. They excel because they're taken out of that environment that says they can't achieve into an environment that says, hey, with a little help, you can achieve. Okay, and like I said, it's all rooted in ignorance. All this division of race, civil rights, it's all rooted in ignorance. The very people who once fought for civil rights are now the very people who are keeping us divided. Okay, why is it that Senator Biden can say something and nothing happens? Trent Lott says something and everyone demands his damn head. Okay, so you see what I'm saying here. I'm saying, okay, it's okay if a liberal says it. It's just misunderstanding. You know, Mr. Biden really didn't mean it. But if Trent Lott praises a 100-year-old man, everybody wanted his head. Why is it that they get to craft what is diversity, what is equality, what is race in this country? Why are we not out there saying, hey, this is what we believe race is?
Can I ask one quick question? Would it be progress for conservatives then if the media came down hard on Senator Biden as they did on Senator Obama?
No, because they're not. Because, see, 90% of your press in this country agrees with what Senator Biden says. I watch the media from MSNBC to Fox, all these. And I watch how they carry a story. When it's a conservative that says something that's what they consider out of the mainstream, there's 24-hour coverage on it, okay, except for maybe Fox. Okay, when Senator Biden, after it was a little brouhaha, CNN came, gave him basically 20 minutes to explain what he meant, unabated. Okay, well, I didn't really mean that. I didn't offend any Americans. All I'm saying is they're a comprehensive segment of our society. They're well-performing. And statistically saying a lot of them own their own private businesses and they happen to be Dunkin' Donuts or whatever. Okay, that's what I'm saying. Okay, now, if that was a conservative, we know if he went on MSNBC, Chris Matthews would have been, you know, hard-boiled, whatever. So what I'm basically saying is, it's time for conservatives among themselves, without outside influence, bringing the greatest and best minds in our movement together and having a genuine debate on race.
Okay, it's getting past that time, so immediately come to Sunday. Hi. Last question, and then I'm sorry for the delays, and I wish this could go on.
Don't worry
night,
about it, Marcus.
But you go on, and then we don't have to do that at all.
Okay. Mr. Taylor, just like two quick parts to my question. The first part is, assuming that what Mr. Derbyshire says is true, and that we get some kind of comprehensive immigration reform that stops significant immigration to this country, especially illegal immigration, let's say 50 years from now, do Hispanics join in whites just as every other immigrant group did? I mean, there were the know-nothings against the Irish. There were the Italians, which was the subject of the 1924 bill. Do Hispanics join whites, or do they stay outside of the group? And then secondly, what do you think whites in the United States, but more specifically in Europe, if you were in more of a leadership position, what would you do to advocate them? What would you do to make sure that, especially in Europe, they maintain their majority status? I mean, how would you encourage birth rate? What would you do?
Well, those are two interesting questions. I suspect that even if immigration were to stop tomorrow, I think Hispanics 50 years from now would not be indistinguishable from European Americans. I think that it certainly was the case that despite the fears of the know-nothings, the Bohunks and the Sheenies and the Jaimes and whoever all else, they all integrated in a way that such that after about three generations, you can't tell an Italian from an Irishman from a German. I think that reflects two things primarily. The one, the more fashionable thing to point to, is a common cultural heritage. The second is their common race. In the case of Hispanics, I suppose you could make some stretch and say that there is a certain Western cultural heritage that comes from Spain, but it's an attenuated one. It's not really the heritage of Europe that Mexicans bring with them. And at the same time, there is this terrible obstacle of race. I think for all of those reasons, as well as for the fact that they have arrived in such numbers and have established such a critical mass in terms of language and culture and national loyalty, that even 50 years from now, they would continue to be an indigestible mass in the American body politic. Now, as far as the Europeans are concerned, I think the problems that they face are exactly the same as the ones we face. What astonishes me is that they don't have the psychological mechanisms that permit them to defend themselves. They cannot be told, we are a nation of immigrants. They cannot be told, look what you did to the blacks. And yet, for some reason, no matter where you find them, whites have been psychologically disarmed in the face of what ultimately amounts to dispossession. Now, I think there are a few European countries that are beginning to stir. Denmark, for example, is one of the most successful in terms of realizing and even being explicit about the fact that if we wish to have a Denmark that is recognizable to our descendants as a Denmark, it has to be populated by Danes. Now, I think that as time goes by, the differences in the social outcomes in Denmark as opposed to Sweden, where they still have this notion that anybody from anywhere can be a Swede, you will see a remarkable divergence in outcomes in those countries in which the Danish outcomes will be seen as desirable, the Swedish outcomes will be seen as undesirable. So in some respects, I have more hope for Europe. Europeans, as I say, they do not have this tradition of racial guilt. They do not have the tradition of immigration. And I think that the success of the BNP, someone mentioned the BNP earlier. The BNP is actually way behind some of the European partners. And I think that Europeans, for all sorts of historical reasons, although they do face the same challenges, are more likely to be successful in overcoming.
Okay. The elevators all shut down. I think we may be stuck here overnight.
No, but go down, jump right up.
Okay.
Okay. So thank you so much, everyone, for coming.